My name is Kristen Turner, and welcome to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Kevin Bartik about his book, Sergei Prokofiev's Alexander Nevsky, which is part of the first cohort of books in the new Keynote series from Oxford University Press. Kevin is also the author of Composing for the Red Screen, Sergei Prokofiev and Soviet Film, which came out in 2013. He is an associate professor of musicology at Michigan State University and specializes in music and culture in Eastern Europe and the U.S. Welcome, Kevin. It's so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here. I'm very happy to be here.
All right. So I'd like to start just by finding out a little bit more about this new keynote series from Oxford and why you chose this piece as the subject for this book.
Well, sure. It was actually the series editor for the keynote series, Kevin Carnes, who originally suggested that I consider writing about Alexander Nevsky. Although I think he would have been happy to entertain other choices. But it really was a logical choice, given the topic of my first book, which you mentioned, deals with Prokofiev's film music as a whole. But I think Nevsky is a particularly interesting choice for the series, because it's one of those rare works in the 20th century where what you might call the academic canon and the performance canon line up. In the academic canon being populated with works that we tend to use as marking key moments and developments in the history of music, you know, the ones we talk about in classrooms and at conferences. The performance canon, of course, being the works that most often show up on concert programs, recordings and such, music that gets listened to a lot. And the 20th century is a time where I think these canons are particularly divergent. But in the case of Alexander Nevsky, we have a work that gets performed a lot, at least in its form as a concert cantata. And since the late 1940s, dozens of professional recordings have been made. But it's also a work that, thanks to its date of composition and its place in Prokofiev's career, really gets held up as one of those key works in music history. In this case, articulating the development of aesthetics in Soviet Russia. And not to mention that the film, Alexander Nevsky, for which this music was originally written, is now a classic, which gives Prokofiev's music a sort of interdisciplinary relevance that I think is really unique and really interesting and opens up lots of doors for more exploration.
Just to make sure that everybody knows this work, I know that a lot of musicologists teach this all the time, but just to give us a little bit of background, can you tell us a little bit about the movie and its place in history, as well as then the score? So we're talking about, you know, both of those aspects.
Yeah, sure, of course. So this was a 1938 film made by the great film director Sergei Eisenstein, for which Prokofiev wrote a film score. And its subject, Alexander Nevsky. Alexander was a real historical figure in Russian history. Lived right in the middle of the 13th century, born in 1221 and died in 1263. And he lived in what's known as Rus, which is the direct predecessor of modern Russia, which was sort of a loose federation of towns and groups in what is today's Western Russia. And Alexander was known for being one of Rus's great military defenders. And his first big victory came in 1240, where at the time he was the Prince of Novgorod, which was one of the major cities in northern Rus. And he's famous for driving back a band of Swedish forces at the River Neva, which is the river that flows through modern-day St. Petersburg. And his victory at this river, Neva, is where actually he gets his nickname, Neva Nevsky. So we know him today as Alexander Nevsky. But the really decisive battle for which he's remembered came the following year. And this is when Pskov, which was a neighboring city, was taken by knights of the so-called Livonian Order. So these would have been knights who came from what would become modern Germany and Estonia. And they invaded from the west. And Alexander, who was 20 years old at the time, led an army to drive the knights back and again spared his city of Novgorod invasion. And largely because of these victories, he became something of a statesman and went on to become the Grand Prince of Vladimir, which was really the most powerful position in medieval Rus. So he's one of the central figures in the 13th century. But really what we know about Alexander the person primarily comes from chronicles that were written in the 13th and 14th centuries, where these battles are really played up as big victories. But this is definitely not a historical figure whose biography was particularly fleshed out at all in the 1930s. So in the film that was made in 1938, Alexander becomes basically everything you'd want a hero to be. He's decisive, he's calm, he's collected, he's a brilliant strategist on the battlefield. He's handsome, he's played by Nikolai Cherkasov, who was one of the great actors of the Stalin era. Listeners might know that he went on to play Ivan in Eisenstein's later film, Ivan the Terrible. But in the film, we're really not distracted by anything extra. We don't learn much about Alexander's life, for instance, and he can come off as a little caricatured. This is a film where the good guy, bad guy contrast is really, really played up. And sometimes my students chuckle at this a little bit when I show them the film. But Eisenstein places Alexander into this film, which has a very straightforward narrative. Its focus is on the second battle, where Alexander repels the Teutonic Knights. And the battle itself takes over a third of the film. So really the plot is very simple. You see the preparation for the battle itself, and in the very famous climax of the film, Alexander eventually forces the Teutonic Knights out onto a frozen lake. And under the weight of their armor, the ice cracks and they plunge to their deaths. And following that, Alexander makes a triumphant entrance into Pskov, which he's liberated. And at the end of the film, he proclaims what became very famous lines. And he says something to the effect of, he who comes to us as a guest, let him come with no reservation. But he who comes to us with the sword shall die by the sword. On this stands Russia, and on this she will stand forever. And these lines are really critical because the film in 1938 was supposed to be understood both as a historical film, but also as an allegory of the contemporary political situation in Europe. And at this point, things looked really bad in Western Europe. And this historical tale was meant to stir up some patriotism and to teach viewers that Russia had always been mighty and there was historical precedent for Russians fighting back the Germans. But in terms of these two artists, Eisenstein and Prokofiev, the film was really significant for their careers, especially for Eisenstein, because Eisenstein had not made a film at all in the 1930s.
Kevin, thank you for explaining how this movie is important and explaining about Eisenstein. Eisenstein, of course, is the director of this movie. Can you now talk a little bit about how this as a film score is important to Prokofiev and Prokofiev's reputation?
So Prokofiev, again, wrote this in 1938. And by that point, he had a very substantial international reputation in place. So we'd certainly know him without this film. But what Nevsky did for Prokofiev was to restore his place in Russian musical culture and Soviet musical culture. He had emigrated in 1918 and didn't return permanently to his homeland until 1936. And when he returned in 1936, of course, this was at the height of the Stalin years. And there was a great deal of suspicion over the years he had spent abroad, even though the Soviet Union had really rolled out the red carpet for him to try and entice him back. But it took the success of Nevsky, both his music for the film and as the cantata that Prokofiev arranged from the film music a year later, to cement his place in Soviet musical culture and kind of prove himself. And so much so, the success of this music even got Prokofiev considered for a Stalin Prize, which was really the top prize in the arts in the Soviet Union. And the transcripts of the discussion of the Stalin Prize committee are really fascinating because several committee members talk about the ways in which the music demonstrates how Prokofiev had really learned how to speak to Soviet people. And one of the commentators even said that Mikhail Glinka would have been happy to sign his name to one of Prokofiev's songs. And this was really serious praise because Glinka was considered the father of Russian music, sort of in the same way that Alexander Pushkin was considered the father of Russian literature. And the popularity of Nevsky, of course, didn't hurt them abroad either, even if Prokofiev was already a known quantity there. But we can also think of Nevsky as a work that not only firmed up Prokofiev's position in Soviet culture after his repatriation, but it opened the door to later works such as the Fifth Symphony and War and Peace, and these big Soviet-era works for which we really know Prokofiev today. These are among his most popular, most famous works.
I'm interested first, so of course Prokofiev later arranged this as the cantata, but let's first talk about it as a film score itself. I always thought of film scoring as being the sort of magic thing that was different from absolutely everything else. And yet your book talks about it a little differently. Can you talk a little bit about the compositional process and how Prokofiev's earlier music helped him be successful both in this film and his other film scores?
Yeah, sure, of course. I think most of us, if we know anything about film music, are really used to the Hollywood model, where the composer does his or her work after all the filming is done and much of the editing is done. So they're really brought in at the last minute. And that process of providing music for a film is oftentimes very collective, where someone other than the composer might be doing the orchestration or rehearsing the orchestra and so on. And Soviet studios, at least in the 1920s and 1930s, had a far less regimented process here. Music might be written before, during, or after filming, and oftentimes these things made things really messy when it came down to editing at the end, and music and image had to be joined. So when Prokofiev comes to this, he sort of adopts this very fluid model of the Soviet studio and actually writes some music before filming has begun. If listeners know the very famous scene in the film where the Teutonic army advances for the first time and you hear this repetitive pattern as the army advances, this was music that Prokofiev actually wrote before Eisenstein had even begun filming that scene. So he was happy to do that. And in that respect, he could draw a lot on his experience in ballet, for instance, where he was working largely from a scenario, just some ideas of the way things would look, and he would write music of an approximate length to fit that. But what's really unique about the collaboration of Prokofiev and Eisenstein is what happened a little bit later in the production, specifically in the last month of putting this film together. And the director and the composer worked really closely at this point, almost on a daily basis. And they would meet at night, and there's some kind of famous accounts of this that both Prokofiev and Eisenstein wrote. And Eisenstein would supposedly come in and show rushes from that day, so sequences that he had filmed that day or prepared that day. Prokofiev would watch them, go home that evening, write a short little piece of music to accompany it, come back the next day and make a reference recording at the piano, which Eisenstein could then use in the editing room. He could play this, and when he dealt with the montage or putting different shots together, he could do it basically with this music as a reference point. So when it came time to actually record the score and put it with image, there was a certain organic connection that you don't often have in other types of film scoring. And another interesting thing here that I think is really unique about this project is that Prokofiev insisted on being involved at all stages, especially after the music was written. He orchestrated it himself, and he also insisted on being present for the recording process. And he rehearsed the orchestra himself, and he was there largely so he could change things that he didn't think would fit very well in the film or change instrumentation here and there. So he was really insistent that he remain control remain in control, I should say, over the final product into the very end, sort of the same way that he would have done in a ballet, for instance. So he drew a lot on his previous experience in audiovisual genres. And I think this has a lot to do with the fact that he came to film music relatively late in his career. He was already in his 40s when he began composing film music.
So did he maintain that control in all of his film scores, or was it just this one that he was particularly concerned about that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because he, in his career, wrote 8 film scores, and 2 of them were for Eisenstein projects. And the first one obviously being Alexander Nevsky, and the second, Ivan the Terrible. And in both of those projects, the model was very similar. He worked very closely with Eisenstein, was involved in the recording process. The other films are very, very different in the way he approached them. The first two, which came before Alexander Nevsky, the first was a 1934 film called Lieutenant Kija. And this was a film where Prokofiev wrote the majority of the music, having never seen the film. And in fact, he composed a number of the cues for the film by correspondence. He was living in Paris, and the film was being shot in Leningrad, and he conducted this by mail. And his idea was to write a few pieces that totaled, maybe in the end, 15 minutes of music total, that the director of the film could use however he saw fit. So his conception here was largely of film music as almost incidental music for a play. And he did the same thing with a second score that he did in 1936, which was supposed to be a screen version of Alexander Pushkin's Queen of Spades. And the really fascinating thing here is he wrote the whole score, and in the end, the film was never made. So you have this weird situation where you have a film score for a film that doesn't exist. And the other 4 films were Prokofiev wrote scores for these films during the war years, during the Second World War. And he did this largely to make money. He was fairly cash-strapped during the war. So these were projects he took on for that, and they were for relatively obscure films. And he really didn't have a lot of respect for the directors of these films. So the working conditions were not great, and these are projects that are largely today forgotten in terms of Prokofiev's film music.
Well, you're bringing up some details about his life, too, in that answer. And that, of course, brings me to think about how the other reason that Prokofiev is famous, I think, for musicologists anyway, is that he is one of the few composers I can think of artists or anyone who chose to leave the West and move to the Soviet Union during Stalin's reign. And that seems on the outside to be an insane choice, really. So can you talk a little bit about why he made that choice? I know that the other thing that comes out in your book as well is that gave him a rather unique standing within the musical political structure there. So I'd love you to talk a little bit about his biography, and particularly that aspect of it.
Yeah, sure, of course, because it does seem like a very unusual choice. So during the 1920s, Prokofiev really tried to build an international career working from Paris. And he had some real successes here. And he collaborated with artists like Serge Diaghilev, the great impresario. But beginning in 1927, Prokofiev began making trips back to Russia. And the reception he received there was nothing like he had received in the West, particularly because in the West, he was competing with other big-name émigrés, especially Igor Stravinsky. And so the really enthusiastic reception in the Soviet Union was an enormous boost to his ego, and really started to exert a strong pull on him. And another thing is, by 1936, and this is the year that he finally makes the decision to relocate to Moscow, Prokofiev had spent a large portion of his career performing as a pianist, something he often needed to do to put money in the bank. And he really began to resent the time it took away from composing. And in the Soviet Union, state support for the arts was such that Prokofiev could really devote himself entirely to composing. And that was extremely attractive for him. But the decisive moment came when Prokofiev began to understand that to continue receiving Soviet commissions would mean relocating to Moscow. And he made the move, as I mentioned, in 1936. But it wasn't as monumental for him as it might seem for us, because, of course, we have the benefit of historical hindsight, and we know that things were about to get really bad in Stalin's Russia. Prokofiev assumed that he'd be able to continue an international career, just one based in Moscow rather than in Paris. And this in fact, worked out for a while. In 1937, 1938, he went on international tours. And then, of course, the war made foreign travel impossible. And by the time the war ended, things, of course, looked very different. But one of the interesting questions has always been whether this repatriation made Prokofiev give up his interest in modernism. His music in the 1920s is often far more complex and dissonant than it was in the later 1930s and the 1940s. And during the Cold War, this led to English language biographies with titles like, my favorite is Prokofiev, a Soviet Tragedy. And the implication here being that had Prokofiev remained in the West, he might have continued pursuing modernism like Stravinsky and had a very different career. But really, the consensus now, and the consensus that's come out in the last 10 years, is that Prokofiev really had already begun to simplify his music in very significant ways well before he returned to Russia, or at least made the decision to return to Russia. And in fact, when he finally made this final decision to return, he probably at that point found better audiences for the kind of music he wanted to write in the Soviet Union than he did in the West. And of course, the big irony here is that Prokofiev's most famous works today, if you think of Romeo and Juliet, the Fifth Symphony, War and Peace, Cinderella, of course, Alexander Nevsky, these are all the works that have proved the most enduring throughout the 20th century. These all come from his Soviet years, not his years abroad, which I think is really fascinating.
Yeah, it's quite an irony that it's those works from the Stalin period rather than the way he perceived what was going to be popular in the West and what ends up being popular in the West. That's interesting that it sort of turned out to be different. Yeah. So he returns to Stalinist Russia. And of course, as you said, not long after that, things get really bad. And I'm wondering, the Nevsky, the movie, is part of the political, it becomes, or maybe it was even written particularly to be a propaganda piece. And that sort of is part of its history for, until today. So I wonder if you could talk first about how it worked, how this movie worked within the political situation when it was first made. And of course, in those years going through the war and how it, because it's, it is an anti-German movie, but Soviet Union wasn't always anti-German. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Of course. So this film is one example of really a large-scale resurrection of the Russian past in the Soviet sphere during the 1930s. The 1920s, so basically the first decade of Soviet power, there was a distinct disconnect between the Soviet present and the Russian past. And this, of course, was very ideological, very pragmatic, because the path to communism was supposed to be an international one. And it involved casting off the Tsarist past, casting off the Russian past. But by the time we get to the 1930s, there's always been this well-known turn to historical topics in Soviet Russia. And really, this involved a lot of pragmatism on the part of Soviet power, because Marxist-Leninist ideology often fell flat with a lot of common Soviet citizens. This was not emotionally compelling stuff. It was not something that could get a lot of people fired up. But you have these great historical figures who are not only military figures or people of the type of Alexander Nevsky, but you also have the great Russian artists of the 19th century, Alexander Pushkin, for instance. And these figures were in the 1930s, through these large projects like Alexander Nevsky, resurrected and basically called to service in the name of Soviet patriotism, to get Soviet citizens fired up and really behind the Soviet cause and emotionally invested in the Soviet cause in a way that they hadn't been before. And so you have that going on, but I think it's really interesting the reasons why Prokofiev got involved in this project, because by getting involved in this project, he, of course, was getting involved in a propaganda project on some level. But I think he came at it, at least, from a very different angle. Prokofiev had always been a very avid fan of film throughout his life. He enjoyed seeing films. He enjoyed going to the cinema. But the idea of composing a film score for him came relatively late, and it came as a result of two visits to Hollywood. And these visits to Hollywood really piqued his interest. And the first of these visits, which I mentioned very briefly in the book, happened in 1930. And at this point, Prokofiev was on an American tour, and he received an invitation to Hollywood from none other than Gloria Swanson, who had him come to Hollywood and entertained him there and asked him to compose a score for a romantic comedy in which she was starring called What a Widow. And Prokofiev actually considered this offer very seriously. And it didn't work out in the end because Prokofiev really bumbled the contract negotiations. But two things came out of this. And Prokofiev writes about these in his journal very, very directly and very clearly. On the one hand, he said Hollywood smells of money. And he was very clearly attracted to the opportunities presented him as a composer. But then he also wrote, almost very passionately about how much he would like to write for a mass audience. But he was very, unsure of how to write quality music for them, or what he felt would be quality music. And he was very concerned about being perceived as a commercial sellout. And he picked on one of his friends for this a lot, another fellow Russian emigre named Vladimir Dukhelsky. And Dukhelsky wrote classical music under his Russian name, Vladimir Dukhelsky, and then had wrote popular songs and Broadway music as Vernon Duke. And Prokofiev saw this dual personality as a complete sellout, and as something that he was not willing to do. So Prokofiev struggled with this a lot. But really the key moment came 8 years later when Prokofiev visited Hollywood a second time. He was again on tour in the United States, and he had made it as far west as Denver and received a phone call from Paramount. They invited him out to Hollywood. And there were some pretty serious negotiations here. They tried to attract Prokofiev to Hollywood, and it didn't work out because of the tour schedule. But it seems as if Prokofiev really seriously considered returning the following year and writing a film score in Hollywood, and perhaps even setting up some sort of arrangement where he would return every year and for part of the year write film scores in Hollywood. But of course, unfortunately, this was Prokofiev's last tour abroad. He never left the Soviet Union after 1938. So all of these plans came to naught. But he returned to Moscow from this tour in the spring of 1938. And this was the exact moment Eisenstein was looking for a composer for Alexander Nevsky. Eisenstein had hoped to work not with Prokofiev, but with a younger composer named Gavril Popov, who was a rising star in film music. A few years earlier, he had written a successful score for an enormously popular film called Chapayev. And Eisenstein really wanted Popov to write for Nevsky. But for some political reasons, the studio that Eisenstein was working at was really reticent and unwilling to hire Popov. And so this is how Prokofiev came on board, really as Eisenstein's second choice. But for Prokofiev, I think the attraction here was pretty clear. Eisenstein was internationally famous. He was an excellent director. He was smart. He had a lot of respect for music. The film had a huge budget. And I think if Prokofiev was going to do this Hollywood plan seriously, Nevsky would be good practice for this. So Prokofiev came at this, I think, from a very different angle, but really did get himself involved in what was a politically motivated project, and a project that was, in the end, something that led to Stalinist propaganda.
So in the Soviet Union, how overt was it as a propaganda piece? I mean, did people talk about it specifically in terms of World War II, or was that just so understood that, they didn't need to talk about it? I mean, what sort of rhetoric did they use about it?
So Nevsky was doubly successful for Prokofiev. The film itself was a huge hit. And of course, Prokofiev benefited individually from what was a huge collaborative project. But the interesting thing here is that Prokofiev turned the score into a cantata the following year. And in fact, he retained the right to do this in his contract that he signed for the film. The music was already known because of the film, and it also seemed to provide a good model for Soviet music. It was suitably heroic. It was accessible to a wide audience. It had some good nationalist references. And thanks to the film, essentially came prepackaged with content on two levels. There's, of course, the overall narrative of the film, which the cantata approximates. And the other is what Prokofiev really called the visuality of the music. There are lots of moments in this music where, for example, during the battle, there are musical gestures that suggest maybe a sword flying through the air, and you hear these localized things. So the music is very, very evocative. And this played really well with Soviet critics, who highlighted all of these features. Both to praise Prokofiev's accomplishment as a composer, but also really tacitly to say that all of this is the sort of work that should serve as a model. But you asked about the propagandistic and a really political import of this film. And an unusual backdrop to all of this was the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop non-aggression pact, which was an agreement between the Nazis and the Soviet Union in 1939, which basically said that they would agree not to invade each other. And rumors immediately began to circulate that any Soviet art that depicted Germans in a negative light, and this included Alexander Nevsky, had to be shelved. And they would return to circulation, of course, only when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941 and broke this non-aggression treaty. And the rumor is always stuck with Nevsky. You can find it in numerous books about the film that the film really was shelved for these 2 years. But in reality, the film was still shown regularly between 1939 and 1941. Eisenstein kept track of these showings, and there's a good record of this in his archive. And I suspect these rumors that Nevsky was shelved stuck because it makes for a really nice, albeit fictitious, example of the extent to which art and politics were linked in Stalin's Russia, and that the signing of a political agreement dictated the fortunes of a film that was otherwise produced by the country's great artistic minds.
Well, I'm going to have to change the way I teach this song now, this piece now, because I always taught that it was put away. I had no idea.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you for setting me straight. So what about the long-term reception after the war and when it starts to be played in the West? How is that different?
Sure. An important thing to consider here is the film Alexander Nevsky came to the United States relatively quickly and was moderately successful. But the Nevsky cantata, this concert version of it that Prokofiev wrote in 1939, came a little bit later, and it came to the U.S. during the war. And of course, this is a time when the United States and the Soviet Union were allies. And American approval for the Soviet Union was at a high point. And this approval also extended to Soviet art as well. You might think here about the American premiere of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, which was really one of the most celebrated premieres of the war years. And we get a little bit of that with the premiere of the Alexander Nevsky Cantata too. The first of these, the initial premiere, was in March 1943 with the NBC Symphony under Stokowski. But there was also a second, much more publicized performance in 1945 at Carnegie Hall. This one was with the Philadelphia Orchestra under Ormandy. And what's really fascinating for me here is that as far as the critics were concerned, this piece was understood as not specific to Soviet wartime experience or even about Soviet patriotism, but it seemed to say something about the experience of war in general. And to be sure, Prokofiev really had no monopoly on the struggle to victory narrative, which is essentially what this cantata follows. It follows from the film too. But it really was helped a great deal by the fact that most Americans heard the music as a cantata that is not attached to Eisenstein's film. So it was already one step removed from its original context. And moreover, neither in the cantata's text nor the program note Prokofiev wrote to accompany the cantata is there really any explicit tie to Stalinism or communism. And that's to say it was relatively easy for non-Soviet audiences to perceive its subject matter exactly for what it was, an inspirational tale from the 13th century, and really not for how it was used in the Soviet Union, which was as propaganda meant to foster patriotism and nationalism. And so in the book, I talk about other instances in which this music appears in different contexts and is reformulated and understood in different ways that keeps taking us further and further away from the original context of the music. And I think one of the most fascinating, at least for me, things to write about in the book was the recent phenomenon of the Nevsky Film Concert, as it's known, which is where a live orchestra plays Prokofiev's film score to a live showing of the film. And this most often happens at outdoor concerts. And the idea for this and a lot of the work for this was done by producer John Guberman and a composer and arranger named William Brone, who both did incredible amounts of work to make the first film concert happen. And this was in 1987 in Los Angeles. And since then, this idea of a Nevsky film concert has been imitated countless times and really around the world. It's kind of striking. What fascinates me here is how the concert setting, seeing this as an outdoor concert most often, puts the focus on Prokofiev's music. And here the film serves almost as an accompaniment rather than the other way around. And there's also the feat of coordinating everything in real time, which is what makes these film concerts so fascinating to hear and to watch. But it also radically changes the experience of Eisenstein's film. And then, of course, the musical meanings change along with it, too. And just to give you a sense of how far Prokofiev's music had come from its original context in a film meant to stir up Stalinist patriotism, at this original film concert in 1987, AT&T funded some of the performance. And they issued an official statement saying that they saw Nevsky in this form as a vehicle to further Ronald Reagan's commitment to peace and diplomacy, which I really think is one of the more bizarre paths music Prokofiev's music has gone down in the 20th century, considering where it came from.
Well, it does show how much the current political situation can change people's perception of a piece from the original perception of it, right? And Yeah, and of course there are a lot of other examples of that. Beethoven's symphonies were used by both the Germans and the Allies as a musical backdrop to the war, supporting each side. And there's a lot of other examples, but I'm wondering, just on a kind of meta level, how do you feel about that? Like, is it okay to reconceptualize a piece that radically, or is it doing some kind of maybe violence to Prokofiev and to the movie to really take it so far out of its original context? Because that really does change how we are going to perceive that work.
Well, this of course is a really tricky question, but I think it comes down to where you are actually locating what you might call the musical meaning of either the piece or the performance or the audience's experience of it. And in Prokofiev's case, a lot of attention has been given to the content of the music. And that is to say, what sort of meaning we can find within the music itself. And so let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. So we might make a comparison with a piece called Zdravitsa, which in English is often rendered as Hail to Stalin or Toast to Stalin. This is essentially a 15 or so minute cantata that Prokofiev wrote for Stalin's 60th birthday in 1939. And the cantata, as you might expect, it has a text, which is one long love letter to the dictator. And it concludes with the choir likening Stalin to a flame that warms their spirit and their blood. And it's really dramatic. You have sopranos screeching out on high seas Stalin's name. You have works like this that are appearing alongside the Alexander Nevsky cantata. In the case of Zdravitsa, under Khrushchev, after 1956, after Stalin is dead, after Prokofiev is dead, Stalin's name was taken out of the text of the cantata, and it essentially became a cantata to communism rather than to Stalin. And a lot of pressure here is being placed on the text as driving the content of the work. And there have been some recent performances of this cantata, and there's been a lot of hand-wringing over whether that's politically correct or not. And the discussion is stuck largely on the fact that some feel that this is really good music on the part of Prokofiev, just with a really bad text. And there are others that feel that the text corrupts the whole work. But I think with the Nevsky cantata, you have something very different, since there is essentially no corrupting text. Again, you don't have any specific references to Stalin, communism, anything in the text of the cantata. So I think the more important question for us and the more important question for the Nevsky music is how it's being used or how it was used. In 1938, when the music was attached to Eisenstein's film, of course, the music was really good at whipping up Soviet patriotism and nationalism. In 1945 in New York, another moment I write about, as a cantata for concert performance, the music was really good at expressing the excitement of victory at the end of what was a really long and horrific war. One of my favorite anecdotes comes from a record annotator, and I mentioned this briefly in the book, who was fascinated by an outdoor performance of the cantata he saw in Grant Park in Chicago. And this was the late 1970s or early 80s. And he remembers looking up at the buildings that surround Grant Park and seeing neon signs and other things that he associated with capitalism. Well, the music down on stage, which was originally from a communist context, plays out in the situation. And he comments, the audience is completely oblivious to this contrast. And, really the cantata, the Nevsky cantata, is an incredibly accessible work, incredibly attractive work. It's big, it's exciting, and it has the strong struggle to victory narrative that I mentioned earlier. And I think that makes the work successful in a lot of different contexts. And there's rarely any of the kind of hand-wringing you have like you would with a performance of Stravinsky, this Toast to Stalin, or even the cantata for the 20th anniversary of the Revolution, which is another one of Prokofiev's political works.
One last question. Again, it sort of relates to the Soviet, the original place of this composition is that it is supposed to be, I think, an example of socialist realism, which is a term that is used in the Soviet Union by Soviet officials to talk about the kind of music they wanted to hear. But I have never really understood what socialist realism is. What did they mean when they told a composer they either had or had not achieved socialist realism?
How much time do we have? this is a complicated question, but I guess I could start by saying that Soviet artistic production was unionized in 1932, and this followed really a decade and a half of relatively pluralistic artistic culture. And this artistic doctrine, socialist realism, was meant to align art and political goals, and it was introduced through the unions. But the problem was, especially for musicians, that it was introduced in literature. And the main charge of socialist realism was to, the description that gets thrown around, to give a historically accurate artistic depiction of reality in its revolutionary development, which was confusing for musicians. And further, art was meant to display nationality, follow the party line, and have clear content. And so what this meant for music and what this meant for composers was not an easy question. And I would say it was much more difficult for them to figure out than it was, say, for writers who were dealing with words and novels and poetry. And so composers worked this doctrine out. What does socialist realism mean for music? Throughout the 1930s, there was never a moment where this was handed down to them. It was something that was worked out by trial and error. And in practice, so this charge for nationality, following the party line, and having clear content, the nationality part of it meant that there was eventually a reawakening of styles we'd associate with, say, late 19th century Russian nationalism. So here, think of Mussorgsky and Rimsky-Korsakov, where you have a style that had been very nationally marked. And the need to follow the party line and have clear content led to a strong preference for texted genres, such as cantatas or programmatic instrumental works here, because here the text helped a lot answering the question, what is this music about? Which made it a lot easier to answer the question, is this music that that suits political goals or not? But I think the most significant thing here is that content had to be easily perceived, of course, which is really the factor that led to a very conservative musical style. So nothing dissonant, nothing formally complex, nothing that might potentially alienate a listener. And so by the end of the 1930s, largely by trial and error theorizing on the part of critics and trying to figure out what does this mean for music, Soviet music had really dramatically narrowed on a style that resembled late 19th century national style in many ways. So socialist realism in music was something that was really easy for contemporary observers, especially in the West, to pit against modernism, where, of course, the values are quite different. But what's significant here, I think, for Soviet musical culture as a whole is there were no significant deep changes to the socialist realist program after Stalin's death in 1953. And just as an aside here, if listeners don't know, one of the really sad, interesting, bizarre things here is that Stalin and Prokofiev die on the same day, March 5th, 1953. So after this, there's no big change in the socialist realist program. There's a lot of talk about how under Khrushchev, there's a loosening of hardline Stalinism, often called the thaw. And many younger composers flocked to Western styles and approaches, things they felt that they had been denied under socialist realism. But there was always still a core of more official composers who were writing in a socialist realist style. So this is an abiding doctrine that was one of Stalinism's dubious gifts to Soviet culture as a whole. And I think just a last point here, the way Alexander Nevsky fits into this really significantly, this development of socialist realism, is all of these things that by the 1930s, composers thought socialist realism should be. So accessible, national in character, not complex, very, very tuneful. Prokofiev's music for this film had all of this in spades. But of course, it originated as film music. And Prokofiev was largely writing here to suit the film. And of course, you've got Russians versus Germans in the film. So he decided to have the Russian music sound Russian. So he appeals to the National School of Composition there. He didn't want to alienate his listeners. So the music is relatively straightforward and not overly complex. So he ends up largely by writing for the goals of the film, also writing music that was this incredible positive example of socialist realism that, of course, composers imitate because it was very successful. And they hoped that in imitating it, they too would be successful. And this process narrows the remit of socialist realism down even further. So it was this gradual process that brought this about. And I think that leads to a lot of the uncertainty and a lot of the confusion that surrounds socialist realism in music in particular.
Well, thank you very much. That's very helpful, actually. So, well, I think this would be a good time to stop, but I really appreciate all of your, all taking the time to go through this interview. And I just want to say what a great book this is. I really appreciate how you were able to take in a really a short book, a deep dive on one piece, but also then to open it up to the really interesting issues that this piece, both as a piece of film music and as a cantata, really opens up, whether that's talking about the political context or just the way that this particular piece works. So thank you so much for talking to us and for this book as well.
Well, thank you. The book was a great fun to write because it's fun to pick up a single work and especially one that is turned up in as many different places as Nevsky and really follow its career through the 20th and 21st centuries. It was a lot of fun. So I'm very happy to be here to talk about it. So thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll talk again soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.